On a spiritual level, what is needed for us to overcome? What's required so that we can replace bad habits with good habits? As we get into this message today, I'd like for you to turn to Psalm 119. Psalm 119 in verse 172, we find part of an answer to this as we set the stage, which simply says, "My tongue shall speak of your word, for all of your commandments are righteousness." Part of overcoming is distinguishing between those things that are righteous and those things that are not, those things that are godly, those things that are worldly. If we go to the next verse there that's on the slide, Romans 13, we find a premise, a foundation for how we should live life, what we should build on. Following up on Psalm 119, verse 172, we go to Romans 13 and verse 10, where Paul writes, "Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. Those commandments that lead to righteousness also express love." These verses, just these two, show us that when we sin, what we're doing is placing sinful habits as more important than God's word. And I'm sure that sounds harsh, but when we sin, what we're saying is that we value the sin more than anything God is offering, if it's only for that moment. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. But we're reminded that it is sin later when we compare the two. But this is why it's imperative for us to overcome our human nature by working with God's Spirit in us. The disconnect between not valuing God's law, His commandments, fulfilling it through love all the time, and the sin that we can then express in the things that we say and do and think and so forth. And in considering this aspect of overcoming, we need to remember that it's not frivolous things. That can be important things on a human level, but we're concentrating here in this discussion on spiritual things. So while it can be important in our physical life in terms of what we eat and how much we exercise and so forth, what we're talking about goes deeper than that. We're talking about changing our human nature from being receptive to Satan's way of life, what he promotes, to being receptive to God's way of life and what he is offering. As a consequence, it involves that we think differently. It involves thinking spiritually first and foremost regarding everything we do in our lives. And so then we come to the next verse there, James chapter 1. It is not enough to have knowledge of God's way of life. I've come across in my life, even within the church, but certainly as an elder and a pastor, a number of individuals who could quote chapter and verse to a level that most people can't. When it comes to knowledge of God's word, in many cases, they were above average, way above average. But oftentimes, sadly, even though they could do that, they couldn't live it. And this is what we find in James 1 and verse 14. It says, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." That is, if we do not change how we think, the sinful thoughts that we can have then begin to be expressed in sinful actions. And then if we're not careful, those actions become habits. If we continue in verse 21, he says, "Therefore lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls." Verse 22, "But be doers of the word." It's not enough to have the knowledge. We have to put into practice. We have to put into action living God's way of life, those commandments, and learning how to love as he does. So be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving ourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing himself in a mirror. For he observes himself, he goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. You know, we get up in the morning, we brush our teeth, for men we shave, we comb our hair, we get dressed, we make sure the tie's straight and all that sort of thing. We leave that mirror and we can forget what we look like. The wind blows and our hair's all messed up, we still think it's like it looked in the mirror. You know, we can miss the spot that when we shaved it starts bleeding, we don't see that sort of thing. It's no different spiritually. If we're not observing ourselves, we can be much like this as well. But verse 25, "He who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it. This is why it's not a casual thing. This is why it's not something temporary focused on this life. We have to continually focus on what God is showing us in this overcoming that we're to be doing. So we need to continue in it, and it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work. This one will be blessed in what he does. 2 weeks ago, I gave part one in this sermon series on habits and overcoming, and I started out by asking the question, can we make a habit of overcoming? I believe the answer is yes. We went through part of that, but throughout the balance of that sermon, then we looked at the power of small changes that aggregate over time and build up to something really big and powerful. In that sermon, we looked briefly at scriptures that direct us to overcome the negative aspects of human nature. And as is touched on even in the sermonette and recent messages, we do that through this regular self-examination that we go through. We looked at some of the history of behavioral psychology and the more recent efforts of changing behavior that focuses on internally changing, how we address and consider the power of habits in our lives. And so we looked at a number of principles. The plateau of latent potential among them. And then we also considered that changing any negative aspect of a habit or establishing a positive habit, that we're really what we're talking about is changing our identity, how we view ourselves. So with all that in mind then, we're going to look at some specifics today in the time that I have and considering overcoming sin by changing and improving our spiritual habits, much like any other habit. So as we get into this today, let me define what a habit is so that we're all on the same page here. A habit is simply behavior that has been repeated enough times to become automatic. That's the definition of a habit. We're not thinking about it. Habits, then, are reliable solutions to reoccurring problems in our environment. But in considering that definition, view problems in terms of anything. A problem is, the most easy way to get to work? The less stress, less traffic, that's a problem we're solving. How do I get ready for bed? What am I going to do? That's a problem we're solving. So problems are not huge issues. It's everyday decisions that we're making. Because the reason habits are so powerful is that whenever possible, the conscious mind likes to palm off tasks to the unconscious mind to do automatically. And so how many times have you found yourself driving somewhere and then suddenly you realize how far you are in your destination, you didn't even realize all the things you passed. Your mind just went into automatic and took care of it. Habits can also be very powerful because, as we talked about in that last message, the feel-good hormone dopamine is released when the reward of a habit is actualized. And our brain actually craves that on some level. We want to feel rewarded for things that we do. In order for us to be in God's family, in order for him to give us eternal life, though, we must overcome our human carnality in this life. This human life, especially expressed in that carnality, cannot have eternal life. This is the whole process of overcoming, changing, becoming like the Father and the Son. And so we read last time Revelation 2 and 3, picked out some highlights, but I want to focus on one verse or two verses there in Revelation 2. Revelation 2, verses 26 and 27. Again, all of the churches, the seven here that John was writing under inspiration to, the directive to every one of them was to overcome. And so as we pick up the thought here, it says, "And he who overcomes and keeps," and "keeps my words until the end, to him I will give power over nations." This is the end result. This is the outcome of what God is asking us to do. If we overcome, part of what he will give us is rulership. Verse 27 then, "He shall rule them with a rod of iron, he shall be dashed to pieces like the potter's vessels." What I want to focus on here and pull out today is the word for overcome. In the Greek, it's nikao, and it has, in addition to the meaning overcome, it can mean to subdue. It can mean to conquer or prevail. Another definition is to get the victory. So when we consider this overcoming, what God is asking us to do is prevail over our human nature, to gain the victory over it, that it does not define us in terms of the calling that God is giving us. This is the offer. So let's go back to Genesis 4, the next verse there, and consider as God exiled Adam and Eve out of the garden and they began to grow their family, they had to teach as well what God had taught them. Part of that instruction was the sacrifices that they were to give. So even in the Garden of Eden, we find the understanding, the knowledge, if you will, that there needed to be a sacrifice to cover sin. But Cain and Abel had a different perspective on what this meant. Abel understood that it had to be life, but blood had to be offered. But Cain thought that he could offer whatever he wanted. He did not bring a blood sacrifice, and God rejected it. So in Genesis 4 and verse 7, God speaks to Cain here, and he says, "And if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do what I'm asking you to do, then I will take care of things. I will be there with you. I will help you." But Cain was embracing his carnality, not rejecting it. God goes on here to say, "And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, personifying it like a burglar. It will dominate you. It's going to wait for you, and it's going to entice you. It's going to overwhelm you. It's going to control you." As he finishes his thought, "And its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." That we are to overcome, using that Greek word, we are to dominate it, to conquer it, to gain the victory over it. We are called to an overcoming life. But that overcoming can seem overwhelming most of the time, can't it? Mr. Kaczynski talked about the examination that we're supposed to do, and we can, if we're honest with ourselves, come up with a very long list at times. But without the right direction or the right tools, we're going to struggle to overcome. But this is why this sermon topic is so exciting to me. We're not left without tools. We're not left without understanding. Let's look at Philippians 3 there. Philippians 3 and verse 9. Philippians 3, verse 9, we're breaking into the thought here, and the context is that Paul is talking about Christ. And so he says, "And so we're to be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is from the law." We read that in Psalm 119. Right? There is a righteousness in keeping the law, but the righteousness is not in the law. That is, we have to go beyond. We have to do. Because if it's just knowing it, that's not the righteousness, but that's part of what Paul is talking about here. If we're just talking about keeping the law, then he says, then I have that. But rather, the righteousness he's talking about, he says, that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which is from God by faith. That we have help. We're not in this by ourselves. Yes, we have to do our part. But we have Christ by our side. We have the Father giving us His Spirit. And so then let's look at some of this in a practical standpoint. Because when it comes to behavior change in psychology, they talk about a four-step process. We looked at some of that briefly last time. And we come back to this. What we're talking about is cue, craving, response, and reward. And I'm going to describe those here as we go through it. A cue is simply a trigger to your brain to initiate a behavior. So it could be your alarm clock in your morning. The alarm clock goes off. That's a cue now, right, to get ready for the day, whatever that means for you. You have to get up, get a shower, you have to get dressed, make your breakfast, you have to fix your lunch. If you take your lunch to work, lay out whatever you need to take. That's your cue, is the alarm clock. So behavior is initiated from that. So then that information predicts a reward. The alarm goes off. I know that once I get those things done in the morning, then I can get to work. We could use other illustrations along this line, but it's very similar to a gambler. I stayed at a hotel one time that was connected to a casino, and it was really interesting to consider everything in there. There's a whole psychology to gambling. For instance, there's no windows in a gambling casino. They don't want you to notice time passing. There are no clocks. They build on the lights and the sounds. When somebody wins, everybody in the casino can hear it. And so they trigger these things. The cue is the excitement, the sounds, the lights, and so forth. But fundamentally, the cue is about noticing the reward. So then the next one is called craving. This is the anticipated change in your state. So craving is about wanting the reward. For the gambler, to use that example, it's feeling the excitement of a win before one card is dealt, before one coin is put in the machine, the anticipation of what it will bring. This is the craving. Following that, then, is what's called the response. This is the habit that leads to the expected reward. I'm a gambler. I go into a casino. I hear the lights, rather, hear the sounds, see the lights. I begin to crave it. Now what do? I decide what I'm going to play, machines or whatever it happens to be, but it's the response to follow through on it. And so then that changes behavior. It drives the behavior, but the reward is not there yet. The reward comes next. The reward is the end goal of every habit. The gambler gambles because he wants the rush of winning. I want to take a little bit of money, and I want to make a lot of money out of that in a very short amount of time. So the gambler chases the reward. We do the same thing in other ways, all of us, on all kinds of levels. But we seek a reward for two reasons. The first is that it satisfies us. It satisfies a craving. And then, secondly, the reward teaches us. And what it teaches us is what actions are worth remembering in the future. So if I'm a gambler, I go in, I hear the sounds, I see the lights. I know in the past that if I played this one table, I won a lot of money. And so then the brain remembers that. And I want to repeat that. But to put a spiritual perspective on this, how then do we begin to address a spiritual habit that we want to overcome? The principles are the same, physically or spiritually. But let's look at it from a spiritual perspective. The simple answer in changing or overcoming is that if we eliminate one of those items, one of those four items, so the cue, the craving, the action, and the reward, if we change any of that stuff, any one of them, then we break the habit. So the simple answer is to eliminate one of them and the habit won't continue, or it'll never start. In other words, what we're doing is making the behavior difficult. Because now if I've broken one of those steps, I have to think about it, I have to make it happen, I have to have the willpower behind it. But if we remove just one of them, typically the behavior stops. It won't be repeated. This might take a little bit of time, but eventually it will. So this four-step process, though, is not something that happens occasionally. It's running and active all the time, every day, every moment. For you to come to church, you had a cue, didn't you? You had maybe something on your appointment book or just a reminder in your head. Today is Saturday. The cue is, I'm going to go to services. And then you begin to have these other actions follow through. The reward is getting here. Having the conversation, hearing the messages, and so forth. So behavior, as we talk about it, is simply a desire to solve a problem. What do I need to do Saturday morning in order to make it to church on time? Each of us will do something slightly different, but that behavior shapes the reward, doesn't it? Let's look at a positive example of this in Daniel chapter 6. Daniel lived in a very interesting time. He was very high up in terms of the political positions in not one but two world ruling empires. I can only imagine the political intrigue he dealt with. But Daniel still had the same requirements that you and I have in terms of overcoming, in terms of staying close to God, learning his way of life, and so forth. And so here we have a conflict here, because Daniel knows that he's up against a wall when it comes to his critics. They have shaped events to put him in a very tight spot. And so he's either going to have to do one of two things. He's going to have to compromise his obedience to God, or he's not. And so in verse 10, we find that Daniel didn't. It says, "Now when Daniel knew the writing was signed, he went home. He went back to his place where he lived. In his upper room, with his windows open towards Jerusalem, he knelt on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God." Notice, as was his custom since his early days. His critics knew this. This was such a habit that he had that they knew that they could count on this to prove that he had violated the new decree. But Daniel wasn't going to break his habit, because the habit was more important because of the reward that he got out of it. What was the reward that he got? What was the problem he solved? The problem is the same problem we all have. How do I stay close to God, and how do I make sure that I do that? One of the things that Daniel did was he prayed to God three times a day. We're not required to face Jerusalem, but this was his habit. This was what helped make it meaningful for him so that he followed through on it. But his behavior was shaped to solve a problem, wasn't it? We know how that story plays out. But there are four laws of change. If we're going to consider changing, there are four things that come into changing behavior. These are steps, if you will, in anything that we consider. How do I make it obvious? I know I need to establish a habit to do X. How do I make that obvious? And then following that, how can I make it attractive so that it's something I want to do? Because we can know that there are things we need to do, and we won't do it. We haven't gone through these steps. The third step is, how can I make it easy? Because as I'll say probably many times today, the human brain is lazy. We want the easy way. We do it all the time without thinking about it. But in terms of changing, we have to acknowledge that. We have to make it easy as well. And then the fourth step is, how can I make it satisfying so that I continue it? We're going to look at each one of these individually. So if you didn't get them written down, we'll come back to them. But let's look first at making it obvious. Physically, we do all kinds of things without thinking about them. I've touched on a few of those examples. But habits are ingrained because our brain recognizes the cue. The craving begins, oftentimes even without us thinking about it. We respond with an action, all without thinking about it, in anticipation of a reward that's coming. So maybe it's a certain time of the day. As you arrive home, maybe your spouse is making supper. You've already been thinking about it. The cue is smelling that smell, and now you're thinking about eating. And everything winds up, doesn't it? Now you have all of these steps coming into play. We do this on a wide range of things, everything throughout the day. But we can even see it in terms of our skills. That when we do something along this line, when we go through these four steps, even in our job, we establish habits. You probably do a certain thing when you show up, especially if you have an office job. When you show up at your desk, there are probably certain things that you do. You have a list of things that you do. Maybe the first thing to do is get a cup of coffee. And then you get to your desk. Maybe you check for phone messages. Maybe you check your email, start answering some of that. Maybe you make a list for the day, whatever it happens to be. We even do that. Well, if you do your task, your job, for any length of a time, you've created shortcuts, and those are habits. Because your brain wants to do it the easy way. So you establish these things. But we gain an insight. When you do your job long enough, you have knowledge that most people don't have. The seamstress that can look at a garment and tell you how it's made and whether it's made well or not, because they have just simply done it for so many years. The mechanic that can hear a little noise, you're saying, well, it's making a funny noise. He has you turn the car on, he says, oh yeah, I know what that is. Because they're so skilled at it, they've done it so often, that there's a perception that comes into this. Well, we need to be tuned into our habits the same way. In order to change a habit, we must become self-aware. Maybe you even have a job where from time to time you might be asked to train someone. Or maybe you've seen somebody given that responsibility. And oftentimes it's easy to say, it's easier for me to do it than explain how I do it. That because that skill, you've gained so many shortcuts, you've established habits for you to do it quickly. Oftentimes you don't even think about how you do it. Well, we need the same thing spiritually speaking. Sometimes we need to stop and slow down and look at what we're doing and analyze the steps to make sure it's the right thing we're doing. And even if it is, then to know what we need to build on. Examining ourselves is always not always a negative. Sometimes it's to look at what's working well. We'll come back to that in a moment and build on it. Let's look at those first two verses up there. 1 Corinthians 11. Paul wrote this, at least this section, it seems, around this time of year when he originally wrote this. The whole last part of chapter 11 is going through this discourse about examining yourselves. Verse 28, he actually says that. Let a man examine himself. But in verse 31, he turns it a little bit, not changing topics, but refocusing it. He says, for if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. Part of the examination, again, is to see what we're doing wrong, but also to see what we're doing right, but so that we can get on the right course. Either way, we can refine it and do even better, or we can stop a habit that's bad and establish a better one. To judge ourselves, this is our responsibilities individually. It's not my responsibility to judge you. Not my responsibility to examine you. We have to do this individually. Let's look at Lamentations 3. I chose Lamentations because we don't normally turn there. But we've read the thought in other places. I just thought it would be interesting to read it in a book many people would probably not consider would have this. Lamentations 3 in verse 40, we read, let us search out and examine our ways. That's exactly what 1 Corinthians 11:28 says, doesn't it? Let us search out and examine our ways and turn back to the eternal. This is what we're looking at when we're looking at this topic of overcoming. We're talking about removing sin so that we can turn back to God. Because again, if it isn't established deeply enough, we'll sin without even knowing about it. The other verses are very similar. We won't go through all those. I put them up there simply if you wanted to write them down. Galatians 6:4 talks about examining your own work. You know, in a corporate world, we would call that quality control. I built this. Is it up to standard? Psalm 26 there talks about asking God to examine me. Sometimes it's helpful to have others point out shortcomings. We can oftentimes be blind to our own faults. Haggai 1 verses 5 and 7 says it this way, to consider your ways. But changing a habit, though, is hard, isn't it? If it was easy, we would immediately change something we saw wasn't working. But it's hard for all the reasons we've discussed. We've ingrained it in our brain. The cue takes us to a place we don't want. We may not even be aware of it. But we do it all the time, don't we? The things that we're not aware of. Which shoe do you put on first in the morning when you get dressed? Typically, we favor one. What hand do you use to brush your teeth? What hand does the toothbrush go in? You want to feel really weird? Do it with the other one tonight. You'll have to even think about how to move the toothbrush because it just feels so odd. It's not the habit. The other hand has it all ingrained. The brain has it down. You pick up the toothbrush, the brain says, yep, I got this. But this is why we're to examine ourselves. Maybe one thing we can do is to make a list of everything, every little thing that you do during the day, and ask the question, does this behavior help me become the type of Christian I should be? Some you'll answer yes to, some you'll answer no to, and some can be neutral. It could be, it doesn't matter what we eat, doesn't matter what clothes we wear, things of that nature. But until we acknowledge what behavior we're doing, maybe going to work a certain way is not healthy for you. Maybe the shortest way is not the best way. When I lived in Rhode Island, I lived about, it wasn't quite 25 miles to where I worked. But in the morning, it would take me about an hour and 10 minutes to make that drive. In the evening, it could take me an hour and a half or more if there was an accident. There was no other way to do it. But getting to work and getting home, I always was wound up between the traffic and the people doing stupid stuff and the accidents and various things. And so I couldn't change that. I couldn't change the drive. But I could change what I did on the drive. That began to help change the attitude. I started listening to sermons all the time, because it would help me not get focused on the stuff being done on the road. But you have to identify those things first. One way to do this is what's called pointing and calling. And you might be familiar with this if you've ever seen a movie, a TV show, where especially something like an airplane pilot, they're getting ready to take off and they're going through a checklist. And so the pilot or the co-pilot, one will say to the other, you know, they'll go through a series of checks. You know, the ailerons and the rudder and, you know, fuel capacity, you know, they go down a whole list. Why do they do that? Because pointing and calling is a very obvious thing in terms of finding something you might miss. If it's one individual doing it, it's very easy to skip things, to miss things. But if someone else is doing it, you have to say something back. You have to acknowledge it. And this has been shown to be very powerful. The Japanese even do this with their high-speed trains. There's a whole checklist they go through before they acknowledge to the conductor that he can take off. What if we did that in our spiritual life? We made a list of things that we wanted to accomplish on a spiritual level through the course of the day. And here's just a little simple, it might seem silly, but very simple thing of saying, you know, prayers said, check. Bible study done, check. Meditation done, check. Working on one sin to overcome, check. Because we have to acknowledge it. It's a great tool to not miss something important. Another one, under making it obvious in terms of changing, is what's called implementation intention. What this simply means is that you say, when X happens, I will do Y. Maybe we're trying to buck the culture of work. When I hear someone cuss, I will do X. I will do Y. I'll leave the room. I'll tell them I don't want to hear that language. Whatever it is you decide that you need to do to address that so that you don't become part of it, because there's a reason we'll come back to later. The people surrounding us can have great influence on overcoming or changing habits. But if you make a specific plan for when and where to perform a new habit, you'll likely, more likely, follow through on it. Lack of motivation in a new or better behavior usually comes from a lack of clarity, and so this is where this helps as well. You've already identified up front, when you see a certain problem, what your response is going to be. Some people call this I will statements. That's the second one on the screen. I learned this a number of years ago from a wonderful teacher named Dave Goffels. He was an instructor in Ambassador College. I later met up with him again out Northwest Camp in Oregon. He teaches in Washington State and has for about three or more decades. But I will, and then whatever the behavior is, and then you make it specific at such and such a time, in a certain place or location. So in going through your checklist, you can say, okay, well, I need to do more Bible study. So I will study my Bible more, but you make it specific. when I have my breakfast in the morning, sitting at the table, I will read my Bible while I have my breakfast. Something like that. Because being specific this way helps to say no to anything that's going to derail that. I already have a plan. I don't want to interrupt that plan. Again, your brain is lazy. It's got the plan. It doesn't want to make a new plan. It's fine with the plan that you have. Another way of making it obvious is what's called stacking habits. And I really like this one. Essentially, what stacking habits is that you take something new, a habit you want to establish, and you add it to something that you already do, something positive. So the thought is to use that positive habit to simply add something that your brain doesn't see as new. I'm already getting ready for bed at night. So if I add doing mouthwash, brain's not going to see that as something different. It's just another step in getting ready for bed at night. And you can add all kinds of things along the way. Because again, in your mind, you're not creating a new habit. You're simply adding another step. And then what's really interesting is that you can change these stacked habits into larger groups. And you can do even more. But the key is to have the right cue to set things off. So again, this is part of analyzing and examining what your life is like. If I need to address a specific problem or an issue, how can I work that into something I already do to begin to address it and change it? So the example I gave this morning in Oshkosh was this. Everybody has their bedtime routine. I went to the dentist about a month or so back. They told me that I've got a pocket behind my back molar that was from an impacted wisdom tooth I had out years ago. Well, they're saying because I have that pocket, they want to do a root canal, they want to put a crown on it. Well, I've gone down that road. I don't want to go that route again. Crowns don't last. They crack. You have to replace them. I've got one tooth that's messed up already. So what can I do if I don't want to have a root canal? Well, I can start doing mouthwash and hopefully help at least not repair, if not continue that degradation in my jawline. Well, I've added other things to this because I'm already getting ready for bed. So how do I do that mouthwash? Well, when I go up to get ready, the first thing I do is I put the mouthwash in while I'm taking out my contacts. The cue is going to bed. The craving is to address these different issues. The reward is multiple things. The end reward immediately is bed. Then get to sleep. But all these other steps I can do that also bring their own reward. So another item that I added was Bible study. Now, I read the Bible all the time, but it's usually for the work that I'm doing. The Sabbath thoughts, the Bible studies, the sermons, counselings. I'm reading the Bible, but I wanted a time where I was just reading the Bible for me. How do I fit that in? The mornings were too chaotic. Too itchy to get emails answered and return phone calls and do different things, and I never established it in the morning. So that's the last thing I do. After I lay out, I do take care of my contacts, a mouthwash, brush my teeth, I lay out my clothes so that I don't bother Roxanne in the morning. And then as I get into bed, my Bible is right there on the nightstand. And we'll come back to this aspect of it. I have no defined amount that I'm reading. The habit is to read. So I've stacked some of those habits. And now it feels weird if I don't do any one of those, because it's all part of the same habit. We also have to consider the environment and the behaviors involved, because environment is the, as psychologists say, it's the invisible hand that shapes human behavior. This is the old conundrum, right? Nature or nurture. Environment, though, does play a large role in what we do. And if you doubt this, the next time you go into the grocery store, look at how they've laid out that grocery store. They put the items up front that are their biggest money makers, what they make their most margins on. Or they'll put them on the end caps at the end of aisles, because people tend to hesitate there. Do I need anything down that aisle? But they'll also put them at the checkout lane, won't they? because they know environment has an impact. They'll also put the items they want to sell the most of at eye level. You're searching for certain cereal. Notice the ones that are right in front of your eyes. Those are the ones they want to sell. You're looking for one that not many people want. It's probably very top shelf or the very bottom shelf. You have to search for it. Most people won't search. They'll grab what's convenient. Advertisers do this in all kinds of ways. And it's not much different spiritually speaking. What does Satan put at eye level? He puts the easy and the convenient. He puts the stuff that he knows that will attract us. He's working us just like advertisers work us. Let's go to Romans 16 there. We shouldn't be without knowledge. That's why I'm going through this. We also need to have a certain wisdom about these things. So Romans 16, verse 19, Paul here says, "For your obedience has become known to all, therefore I am glad on your behalf." Notice this. "But I want you to be wise in what is good and simple concerning evil." Simple meaning not knowledgeable. This is not something you normally embrace. I had a job one time that involved direct mail sales. And the way it worked is that we each had sort of a territory, but we also had an inside guy. And this guy made his commissions on setting up appointments. So he was calling all kinds of places, explaining our product. "Can I get Dan in to see you at a certain date and time?" And if I went and I made a sale, he got a commission off of that. Well, one time I was in the office, I think it was towards lunchtime. They were sitting eating, and he was talking, and he was using all of these negative names about a group of people. I had no idea what they meant. I asked him. They looked at me like I had three heads because I was simple concerning evil. They couldn't believe that I didn't know what those terms meant. When it comes to overcoming, God wants us to have the same understanding here. That a small change, this wisdom that we can have, that when we consider what God is asking us to do, that we're wise in what is good. We see it, we know it, we put it into action. But when it comes to the things that are evil, as it says here, that we're simple about it. We don't get entangled with it. We find a way to grow beyond it, to address it, to put it aside, and to replace it with something better. Because a small change can lead to a big shift. We covered that in the last message. Those 1% increments that aggregate into something really big. Our behavior, though, is not defined by the objects in the environment, but our relationship to them. What cue it has and what reward that it brings at the end. So we need to pay attention to that. If we want to change the behavior and we go to a certain place, location, business, we know that that's not a good place to go because of the action that it initiates, the cue that starts off this chain reaction, if you will, then maybe we then need to not go there. We also need to avoid mixing different habits with each other. The reason why stacking habits work is that you're doing similar things to the same reward. You're not mixing habits that make you shift gears and do something different. Because disciplined people spend less time in tempting situations. So you're not distracted. You're not pulled different directions. You focus. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 15 there to go back a little bit. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, he's talking about his plans. I'm sorry, go forward. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33. He's talking down the road. He's talking the end result of where we all want to be. And when Christ returns after the millennial reign, last great day takes place, those that want to be in God's family are going to be, and those that are not, don't want to be there, are not going to be there. So he's talking about resurrection in this section, but verse 33 makes a very interesting point here. He says, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. That expression was not Paul's. He's actually quoting from a Greek dramatist, Menander, from the 300s BC. This would have been a cultural reference they would have understood. And the Greek word, therefore, corrupt, is ethos. It's only used here. It also means morals. So don't be deceived. Evil company changes the morals. So this is part of what we need to consider. That our environment and our behavior, you know, who do we hang out with? This is the analyzing. I have a family member that went through AA, and he expressed at one point, one of the first things they told him, I've used this before, one of the first things they tell him is you have to get new friends. Why does he need to get new friends? Well, because all of his old friends were his drinking buddies. If he hung out with his old friends, just like an addict, they're the ones that are going to say, oh, one time, it won't hurt. Why are you being such a fuddy-duddy? But Paul uses this expression here, evil company corrupts good habits. That's environment. Let's move to the second point then, and that is that we need to make it attractive. Because the more attractive an opportunity or a new habit is, the more likely it is to become something permanent, some habit that will continue in. We come back to this brain hormone, dopamine. Habits are what psychologists call a dopamine-driven feedback loop. Our brain looks for it all the time, and it looks for reasons to kick it in. So dopamine is released not only when you experience pleasure. At the end of any habit, that reward, it's not just released when you experience that part of it, but also when you anticipate it, the craving step. And this is part of what makes sin so hard to overcome. When we've established sin as a habit, our brain, when we have the right cue, our brain is already kicking in the dopamine. Yeah, I want this. Studies show dopamine rises before a habit action. So even before we act on it, the dopamine is there. So that raises the motivation to act on it. In fact, our brain has more neural circuitry allocated for wanting rewards than for liking them. So the anticipation, the brain actually likes more than the reward. In this light, then, desire is the engine that drives behavior. This is part of examining ourselves. What desires do we have? What habits come out of that? What habits should we have instead? Which brings us to what's called the Primax principle, which simply means the more probable behavior will reinforce the less probable behavior. I've known for years that I should do a mouthwash to try to help some of these concerns the dentists have with my teeth. Never did it. What changed was I used a more probable behavior to reinforce a less probable behavior in the habit stacking. So you need to think about what habits you do that are good habits in terms of spiritual actions, and what can you build on with that? So you could say, after whatever current habit you have, after I do X, I will do Y, what I need to do. This goes back also to the pointing and calling. Maybe you make up a new list of how you go through these processes. But let's look at a few examples that you may not have considered in this light. Matthew chapter 12. Christ uses some language here that I see fits this. Matthew 12 and verse 50. He says, whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and my sister and my brother. The will of my Father. So maybe we substitute not what our will is, but what God's will is. God wants me to do X, so I will do Y to get there. Let's look at John 14 as well. Christ made a series, and this chapter especially, he made a series of these I will statements. Because, again, when you express this, I will do, whatever fills in the blank, I will, the likelihood of that being accomplished rises dramatically. John 14 in verse 13, Christ says, whatever you ask in my name, that I will do. I will. You do X, I will do Y. That the Father may be glorified in the Son. Verse 14, if you ask anything in my name, I will do it. Christ is part of this process with us. We're not alone in this. We're not banging our head against a wall, and we're not struggling against something without any help. If we go to verse 21, he says, he who has my commandments and keeps them. This goes back to Psalm 119, doesn't it? What is our foundation? He who does this, he who has this as a foundation, he says, and keeps them, it is he who loves me. He who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. Verse 23. If anyone loves me and keeps my word, my Father and my Father will love him, and we will keep him and make him, make our home with him. In this case, he's inclusive. We will, instead of I will. To give a comparison, if you want to read Isaiah 14 at some point, you have Satan doing the opposite. And in that chapter, make note of how many times Satan says, I will. I will ascend to heaven. I will be the Most High. I will, I will, I will. He followed through on it, didn't he? The I will statement drives, to a large degree, the actions, and Christ, or excuse me, Satan did it in a very negative way. But we come back to a question of where we get our habits. Whatever habits are normal in our culture are the most attractive to us. Now, culture, I don't mean in a sort of national sense that broad. I'm talking what we grow up in, what we live in. So whatever is normal in that environment is the most attractive to you. This can work for us and against us. Parents can shape, to a large degree, the desire to learn in their children by creating that culture at home. Reading to them, asking them questions, not answering everything, but showing them how to find answers and so forth. In a negative household, you could have somebody who is abusive, and the child will learn how to be abusive. This is why these patterns continue. It's what you know, what you're familiar with. So we don't choose our earliest habits. We imitate them. We learn them because of the culture we're in. And we learn them from these three groups of people. We imitate the habits of those who are close to us. So you see that in a family environment. And oftentimes, I know with my brothers, you can pick us out in a group. They must be siblings. The way we walk and the way we talk and our humor and all these sort of things, we learned it from each other. Those that you are close to can have huge influence over your habits. To use what we're talking about today, they can have huge impact in the positive spiritual things we do or the negative things. Secondly, then, we also imitate those we associate with. So maybe it's not our family, maybe it's not the neighborhood we live in, but it can be the people we work with, or it can be those that we interact with on a regular basis in other ways, but those that we associate with, our friends, or our acquaintances. The third group then is those to whom we defer. So these are people of power or influence, somebody not related, but somebody that you respect, maybe your boss at work, and he's taken you under his wing, you can easily start to reflect his habits. Because you value his comments, his insight. I've had this on occasion with a few individuals that I highly respected, and I find myself repeating things that they've said in the past. So this is why we need to pick our friends wisely. Because they have great influence in how we overcome or even if we can overcome something. So one of the most effective ways to build better habits is to be part of a culture where your desired behavior is normal. What you and I do on a regular basis, what God asks us to do, it's not normal. Not by the world's standards. Who's going to be keeping Passover Thursday night? Not even the Jews. How many people meet on Saturday to worship God and understand what that means? How many people keep the holy days? This is why it's important not to forsake our assembling. We have great influence on each other to validate, to support, to encourage, at times to correct, and so forth. This comes back to environment a bit, doesn't it? Who are we surrounded by? The third aspect, then, is to make it easy. Some of you know, I've talked about at times, that in my past I have an associate's degree in what's called commercial art. This type of work involves things that are done in advertising agencies, the printing industry, creating publications, and things of that nature. So in one of my classes when I was going through art school, we were given the task of creating some logos. And you've got natural ability, talent with some, but some have such a strong desire that they have their own abilities. And so you have a mix of people and what they come up with. But there was enough of the class that was struggling to create any kind of volume of work. They might create one or two logos, but they were kind of stuck. The problem with only having a couple is that the client, even if it's a great design, the client may not like it. They may decide, no, that's not where I wanted to go with it. So you need volume. And I remember what the instructor said, even to this day. He said, put every idea that comes into your mind down on paper. Don't get stuck on the one or two. Because if you do, you won't get past it. See, the brain doesn't want to work hard. So he said, throw every idea down. Just make a sketch, get it down, get it out of your head, move on to the next one. Because he said, you can sort out later which are the good designs and which are not. If you fixate on one or two, you'll never produce more. Well, as I said, that stuck with me. I even do that to this day. On my computer, I have a file in my sermon folder where I have what I call working ideas. Anytime I have an idea, I open up a document, I put the idea on there, and I save it to that directory. Some of them might be half a page. Some of them could be a short paragraph. Most of them are just one line with a thought. But I have to put it down because otherwise I'll get stuck. That'll clank around in my head and might distract me from other things I need to be doing. So I don't worry about whether it's a good idea or not, whether I can make a full sermon out of it or not. I sort that out later. Well, I find a spiritual principle in that. When we're considering overcoming a bad spiritual habit, we can't get bogged down in the details of how we're going to overcome. Because there is no perfect approach. There is no fastest way to overcome. There is no magic bullet. So we come back to the 1%. What are the steps that I can take? And I'm going to do every small step that I can do. And we begin to address this. I remembered this quote from the French writer Voltaire. He said, "The best is the enemy of the good." What does that mean? It's this whole idea. Oftentimes what makes us stuck in overcoming is that we think we have to do it now, and we have to do it all at once. Well, I like the old adage too. What's the first thing you do when you find yourself in a hole? Stop digging. You didn't get there immediately, did you? You put effort. Even if it was to the wrong end, you put effort into it. It's not going to change immediately. So you have to reverse the process. The best is the enemy of good. The good is the 1%. And if you add up enough of those 1%, then you're going to get the best. Eventually, you'll get there. If we wait for the perfect plan or the perfect time to overcome or change, then we probably never will. We say to ourselves all the time, I'll do that next week. I'll do that next month. I'll do that next year. And those times come and go, don't they? And we keep saying it until we're years and years down the road and we haven't changed anything. So the key is to overcome by building on positive repetition, not perfection. The goal is perfection, but those aren't the steps. The steps in between are the repetitive things. Reading my Bible every night is repetitive, but there's a purpose to it, isn't it? I will build on that. Because another thing that I've discovered I do, I've stacked onto that habit, I take my phone with me to bed. Normally, I'll turn it off at the end of the night, but I take it with me to bed because more often than not, when I'm doing my reading, something will come to mind. That would make a great Sabbath thought. So I email myself. And in the morning, it's sitting there waiting for me to put in my idea folders. But you build on the good to get to the best. What happens is then behavior becomes progressive. We build on it, we build on it, and we build on it. We do that long enough, then it becomes automatic. And again, we do this in all sorts of things. If you have to make something and you've gotten really good at it, you've done that through repetitive behavior. You know how to cut the wood. You know how to sand it down. You know how to plane it. You know how to shape it. You know how to fit it. You know how to put it together until you get to a point where you've built up all these things and now you create this great product. So repetition is not our enemy. It's our friend. We get bored with repetition, but that's why it has to be easy. That's why it has to be attractive. Let's go to Isaiah 28. This is actually a principle in Scripture that we don't consider often. We look at it solely in terms of knowledge that God gives us in His Word, and that certainly is the case, but I'm not stretching the intent here by applying it to overcoming. Isaiah 28 and verse 10 says, "For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little." Now, Isaiah was condemning Israel because they were not doing this on a spiritual level. But again, I think the application is very similar here. Repetition is a form of change. So then the question becomes, how often do we need to repeat a behavior for it to become a habit? And the answer is, it depends on how often we do the new behavior. If we do something once a month, it's going to take longer than once a day. But maybe once a day is not attractive. Once a day is not easy. So again, we have to just go through this process. Precept and precept and precept and precept and then line and line and line and line until one day we realize we're here. It's been accomplished. It's been addressed. It's been overcome. No habit develops after one time. Even the most powerful drugs, you have to go back to it before you get hooked. Some habits are built over the courses of decades. We're not going to change that overnight. This is why it's so awesome that God is so patient and merciful to us. He realized that it didn't take us one day to get in that hole. It's not going to take us one day to get out. But as long as we're working to getting out of that hole, He's happy to be part of the process with us. The key, again, is to make it easy. And anything becomes easier with practice, doesn't it? This is the good. We can't practice perfectly all the time. We're not going to be perfect all the time. But we can practice to become perfect. And if we do that regularly, then we will at some point become very good at it. Colossians 4 there simply talks about redeeming the time. How do we do that? Could I offer to give God $1,000 to give me back yesterday? We can't buy it back, can we? It's gone. What we can do is redeem the time so that the future is more valuable. So we put into practice these things we're talking about. We put the effort in. We make a plan. We make it easy. We make it attractive. We build on the 1% to make the future more valuable. Because we're moving in a better direction. Another aspect then in terms of looking at this point of making it easy is that we look at what's called the law of least effect. Because humanly, we're lazy. Our brains are lazy. Our brains look for the habits all the time because it doesn't want to put work into it. We don't want to constantly be thinking about, how do I drive to work? The brain says, okay, I like this route. I like this way. We're going to do this every day because I don't want to think about this. We'll just do it. And so this is the law of least effect. A person has to use an example, a person has to decide between two similar examples, two similar options. Which do you choose? Well, this law of least effect, in practice, we will gravitate towards the option that requires the least amount of work. Okay, do you want steak tonight for dinner or do you want Chinese? Well, what do we have in the fridge? Well, I've got all the ingredients to make the steak dinner, but if you want Chinese, we have to order out. So which is the easier? Depends on what you like, but you can see we have to choose. We'll gravitate, whatever the choices are between the two, we'll gravitate to the one that takes the least amount of work. And so we can determine these things every day. What shoes am I going to wear? Well, I like these shoes. I've got them broken in. And so we wear them every day to the point that we wear them out. Well, I don't want to get new shoes. I still like these. Well, you've already got 5 pairs in your closet, but I like these. This is the choice. This is the easy choice because they don't pinch my toes and all of this. This is why it's critical to make new habits as easy as possible. And we do that by having as many things working in our favor as possible. So we come back to environment in some ways. But let's look at Proverbs 5, verse 8 there. You can see how this becomes a package. All of this stuff we're talking about, how it plays in with itself. It comes back and forth, and you can't have one without the other. And it's all sort of programmed into us. And it can be negative, but we can also use it in very powerful ways. In the context of chapter 5, Solomon here is teaching his son the great harm that getting involved in adulterous affairs can cause. So what does that have to do with us? Well, just think about this in terms of sin. So Proverbs 5, verse 8, remove your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house. Sometimes the law of least effort leads us to sin. This goes back to analyzing and considering. And maybe then the law of least effort is to find something that will take the place of us gravitating towards those bad things that are so easy. So don't even go there. Find a different store to go to. Find a different way to drive to work. Find a different stacking habit pattern. Because sometimes we just need to do something different. Many of you might remember the Nike advertising they did some years ago. It says, do it. Well, what they were capitalizing on was that most people, if they think about being in shape, they think about these top-tier athletes, you know, lean and fit and just great at everything they're doing. And that's not the average person, is it? And so we can be overwhelmed by that. So their tagline, do it, was very similar to what we're talking about today. Okay, just put on a pair of shoes and start walking. Just do it. Just do whatever. Doesn't matter if you're the best at it or not. And as I said in my sermon last time, kids are horrible at everything, aren't they? Because they're new at everything. They're not experts at anything. They put shoes on the wrong feet. They put clothes on backwards, inside out. They miss their mouths when they're learning to eat, but they don't care, do they? Because they're trying to understand. They're trying to fit all this into their world. So when we look at this on a spiritual level, instead of saying, I will read the Bible from cover to cover this year, maybe that's overwhelming. Maybe you just say, I will read 2 chapters tonight. Maybe that's too hard. Maybe you just say, I will read my Bible tonight. It's the Nike tagline, do it. Simply do it. This is another aspect of making it easy. Just do it. Don't get caught up in the excuses or allow other things to become stumbling blocks or walls before this. Just do it. And so maybe some of these things we do in the morning before we get going. Maybe we do it at night when there's no other distractions. However it works in your life. Because what we're doing is validating the new identity. You put on a pair of shoes, you start walking. Now you say, I am a walker. That changes your attitude and your perspective on viewing this. The converse of this is to make a bad habit easy to overcome, we make it difficult. Because if you make it difficult, our brains being lazy, we won't want to do it. It's too hard. The last point then is to simply make it satisfying. In order to establish any change in behavior, it has to satisfy us in some possible way. The brain is looking for that dopamine. It's lazy. It has to satisfy us in an immediate way or we won't continue in the behavior. Now, that's a short-term, immediate gratification look, isn't it? We have to be careful with that because we can prioritize the wrong things. The trick is to create a behavior that is immediately satisfying but also has long-term positive outcomes. And that indeed is a challenge. Again, that's why many people don't succeed in changing behavior or overcoming things. And so we're considering this aspect then of gratification. We live in a world of immediate gratification, and this is another tool of Satan. He makes it easy, doesn't it, to sin? You don't even have to search it out now. You can have things pop up on your computer screen that you never clicked on. You can have billboards driving down the road that have advertisement for things that you don't want to consider. Movies and TV and all kinds of things. He makes it easy. So how do we delay the gratification for something positive but reward it immediately? Well, I use this example. I knew someone one time that had a problem doing impulse buying. They knew they shouldn't spend the money. Oftentimes, they would purchase things, they would get them home, they would sit in boxes, and at some point, they would say, I don't even know why I bought it. So how do you address that? Well, one of the things they did was they didn't want to get rid of all their credit cards. They did get rid of a few, but they needed to keep some of these cards for various reasons. So to remove the immediate gratification part of it, they filled up a bowl of water, put their credit cards in it, and put it in the freezer. So now they need a credit card. What are they going to do? Well, you got to wait till it falls out. That kind of takes away the immediate gratification, doesn't it? But it doesn't satisfy the long-term thing. The long-term thing was they wanted to get a better handle on their finances. We can see this in other ways. Maybe you know that you need to plan for retirement. You need to be saving money. But putting $5,000 in your Roth IRA this year doesn't give you an immediate satisfaction, does it? That's just $5,000 that is gone. You're not seeing the retirement yet. That may be decades down the road. But maybe you, before you put it in that Roth, you have different envelopes for things you want to do in retirement. Maybe there are certain trips that you want to take. Maybe there's a certain place in terms of even the country you want to live. Maybe there are other hobbies that you want to take up. So you label those things, you put money in it, and your brain is saying, I've already invested in this. Even though it may be years down the road. There are other ways to look at this. Ben Franklin did a very interesting thing. He had a chart that had what he called his 13 virtues on there. So I don't know if you can, oh, there it is. I don't know if you can read all of that, but he had temperance, he had frugality, he had all kinds of statements up there. Now, what he would do to address this, because this is long-term change in behavior, but you have to address it at some point in the short term to get to the long term. So what he would do is he would take one of those on the list, and then the other 12 he would practice that week towards that goal. So for temperance, he would do things like moderation. He would do things like frugality. He would do these other aspects of the virtue, and he would chart it. Monday or Sunday through Saturday, how did I do? I succeeded Monday doing this one. And he had at the top, he had the days of the week. Down the side, he had these various virtues. How did I do on temperance today in considering it for moderation? This is just one way of looking at it, that you can create a list. And in this way, we measure a habit, but we have to make sure we're measuring the right thing. Ben Franklin saw these as very valuable in being a more complete man, a person that was balanced. But the list is not the goal, it's the change. So let me ask a question at this point. What is the number one enemy of maintaining a habit? It's the failure to perform the habit. One time, though, of forgetting or failing to perform a habit will not doom us. We have a new habit stack that we do before we go to bed. But one night we miss it. We're out of town. We have guests over. We get out of our routine. That's not going to kill the habits. But if we do it 2 nights in a row, 3 nights in a row, now we're establishing the habit of not doing it. Loss in habit performance quickly undoes any gain. Last time we looked at that 1%. Over the course of the year, it may not seem like a lot, but you add up multiple areas of 1%, it is a lot, and then you compound that over years and years, and it's huge. But the negative is just as powerful. If we don't do something in one area, and we don't do something in another area of our life, those start adding up. And then over the course of the year, it's a large amount. Over the course of many years, we're in a place we don't want to be. This is the hole many people find themselves in. So whatever habits you generate to address, change, and overcome, don't break the pattern more than once. This is why it needs to be easy. This is why it needs to be attractive, so that our brain will establish it, will not fight against it. One thing that can be done is what many people do. You make a contract with someone else. So I want to go to the gym, but I know that I'm not going to go to the gym by myself. So I find somebody that wants to go to the gym with me, because now I have somebody that will hold me accountable. Dan, you're not at the gym today. Where are you? Oh, I was too tired. I didn't feel like coming. Oh, that's not good enough. Get your butt down here. We need to do this today. Okay. That can be a huge boost, because now we've got somebody sort of helping us stay on track. This, again, is the value of us being surrounded with members of like mind. We can hold each other accountable. Not that we have to pry and not that we have to dictate, but as we share things with one another, that we can say, you sure you want to do that? Sometimes just saying that to somebody, they'll say, yeah, I know where you're going. No, I don't want to do that. In all of this, there's a great amount of information and knowledge out there about changing habits on a physical level, of changing and overcoming things of this nature. But one thing that's going to be missing in any of these books that you read along this line is the spiritual component. But that's the advantage that you and I have, that the world currently does not have. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 10. God is very gracious. He's patient. He's merciful. If there was justification that we needed to be at a certain level before he would interact with us, probably almost every one of us wouldn't be there. So the spiritual component is huge. Because we have someone, to go back to my previous point, we have somebody there with us. Jeremiah 10, verse 23, Jeremiah writes this under inspiration. O Eternal, I know the way of man is not in himself. We're lazy. Our brains are lazy. We're not going to know the right way to do things. Left to our own devices, we'll choose the easy thing, and we'll choose the thing that's probably not the best thing for us. Spiritually, it's not any different. We don't know front from back when it comes to understanding God's plan of salvation. It's not in our way. The rest of the verse, it is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. We get too easily sidetracked. The shiny object pulls us off course. The distractions that come along. So verse 24, this is Jeremiah's solution. O Lord, correct me. But we have to be careful with that. And Jeremiah does that. He says, correct me, but with justice. Not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. If you don't have a clue what you need to address, then ask God. But always remember to ask him to do it in mercy. Because you have to be careful what you ask for. I knew an individual when I was at Ambassador College that looked at his life and realized that he wasn't learning much. He needed to overcome some things. He thought life was too good. He needed to be challenged. So his prayer, as he expressed it to some, was that he was asking God to give him a trial. And we said, Are you sure you want that? Yeah, this, I need to grow and overcome. Okay, well, he got his trial. We need to remember this here. It's not wrong to ask, but also make sure that God knows that you want it in a way that you can address. That you want it from him in the 1%. Give it to me slowly so I have a way to handle this. But God is there in the process. For us to rule ourselves, we have to overcome our weaknesses and faults. So this is why he said to God, he asked him to correct him. But overcoming spiritual habits are hard because we're seeking to change ingrained rewards. Going back to the things that we talked about, we read James 1, verse 22 to 25, where James was talking about looking in this mirror. God's word should be like that. As we read through it on a regular basis, do we see ourselves for who we are carnally? Not to beat ourselves up. When we come to Passover, it shouldn't be to scourge ourselves. It should be to acknowledge that God in his mercy knows where we are, we know where we are, and we need to be there so that he can take us forward. We read Psalm 119. But in verse 134 in that chapter, he asked the psalmist to redeem him. He asked God to redeem him. He's asking God for his help. In seeking to change our habits, we need to remember to ask God to be there with us, to show us what needs to be changed, to help us see how to change, to give us the strength and encouragement to change. Because, as we were told in the sermonette, he's in the search and rescue business. He wants us to be in his family. He wants us to overcome. He wants us to be there. So he wants to help us succeed. God indeed wants us to be eternal as he is, to live in his family. But in order for him to give us eternal life, we must overcome our carnal nature. We must overcome Satan and the world around us and take on the mind of Christ. Overcoming bad habits and sin is not as hard as it may seem. It's certainly not as hard as we make it out to be at times, because we have the tools and knowledge to overcome. We have God's Spirit to guide and strengthen us. We have the directive from God to overcome and know that he's with us in the process. So we come back to the question, what do you want to overcome in your life?